Robinson? Good morning. Good morning.
You're in the zone.
Yes. I'm having a lot of sleep in my house.
Oh.
I remember those days. I thought I'd go nuts after four of them.
Well, I can tell Alexander, he's making it clear that there will be no brothers and sisters. House Water Environment Committee will come to order. We're going to open with House Bill 91 this morning. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 3491. And ask the staff to read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3491 specifies that the State Land Board has exclusive jurisdiction over administrative determination of navigability waterways.
I have someone coming to testify on the bill, but I don't think they're here yet.
Okay, well, we'll take what we have, and then we can always come back to this.
Okay.
Directs the board to complete and provide compensation to property owners for loss of claim, title, or interest in property caused by adoption of report of determining navigability. Thank you.
Do you have present on this thing?
Well, what I discussed with this guy, this is the first time we've ever put a bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to talk to you about having it be later in the agenda so he could kind of watch what was going on.
Okay.
But he's not even here yet.
Okay.
The presenter of this bill is not yet in the room, so we're going to recess this particular part of the hearing for this bill and wait for those people to show up. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on H.R. 2, commemorating the 30th anniversary of Oregon's bottle bill. The bottle bill was passed by the legislature in 1971. And it reduced litter, increased container recycling, fostered a recycling ethic among Oregonians, and helped pave the way for future recycling efforts. Before the passage of the bill, beverage containers made up as much as 40% of the roadside litter. By 1973, after passage of the law, they were only 10.8%. By 1979, they were down to 6%. This level of litter reduction continues today. So I'd like to call forward Sandra Bishop, Container Recovery.
Thank you. My name is Sandra Bishop, and thank you for allowing me to be here this morning to celebrate the 30th birthday of the Oregon Bottle Bill. I represent Container Recovery, Inc. up in Portland. Some of you on the committee have actually toured the facility, so you have a little bit of a better idea of what we do up there. No one thinks much about what happens to the containers after you go back to the store and get your nickel. Well, someone has to recycle all those containers, and that is exactly what Pink does. Pink started in 1987 by the beer and wine distributors and the soda distributors, in order to make it easier to collect those containers and get them recycled. So without further ado, I'd like to go ahead and just show a really short video. Just one thing of note about the bottle bill. There are 10 states and one city that has bottle bill. And as far as I know, we are the only state that has no public money in the system to recycle the containers and to actually handle all of the bottle bill. We have the OLCC is responsible for enforcement, but they don't get very many calls on it. So I'll go ahead and show the video, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions later if there are any.
as well as our people are unique. Oregonians have long been committed to preserving this beautiful land. Our methods are sometimes as unique as the people. In Oregon, we focus on what works. In 1971, our legislature developed a unique program that over 25 years later is still doing just that, working. The Oregon Bottle Bill has been a grand success. It is truly a demonstration of how governments, private industry, and the people can all work together to create a credible result. In the next few minutes, we are going to look at the Bottle Bill, discover what it is, how it works, why it's unique, and why it is so important to the people of Oregon that this well-run program stays unaltered. Let's begin at the beginning. The Bottle Bill was adopted and became law in 1972 with four aggressive goals. First, to control the increasing river fauna in the state. Second, to keep the beautiful roadways and waterways of Oregon clean. Third, to recycle our valuable natural resources. And fourth, to conserve landfill space. The challenge was great. Oregonians at that time were using over 544 million containers every year. It is now over 1 billion. The Bottle Bill mandated that many of these containers be returned, refunded, collected, then recycled. This tremendous job fell on the retailer and wholesale beverage industry. And to be quite honest, they were not set up to do the job. Imagine trying to provide storage for the returned bottles and cans. Hire and train additional people to keep track of the accounting and paperwork now required, and deal with the increased cost the program represented. It was in 1985 that the wholesale beverage distributor industry stepped forward to address this increasing problem and look for a solution. In October of 1987, Container Recovery, Inc., or CRIC, was formed as a nonprofit, member-owned cooperative corporation. CRINC is a centralized system created specifically for the sorting, accounting, processing, and recovery of returnable bottles and cans and their deposits in the Portland metro area. Here's how the system works. CRINC drivers pick up the empty containers at nearly 100% of the retail outlets in the Tri-County area. This totals nearly 12,000 truckloads every year. The driver records the case and bag count on an invoice and pays the retailer for the containers with a negotiable bank draft. Each bag and case is marked and collected. The driver then takes the load to the CRINC warehouse, a 65,000 square foot recycling facility. At the loading docks, the deliveries are verified and double checked against the invoice. Cans are put through a mechanized counter. Getting a reliable can count is critical. Once all containers are counted, the final number is entered on a worksheet and compared to the original invoice by the CRINC accounting department. The most important thing CRINC does is the auditing and accounting of all returned containers collected. Overages or shortages are documented on a correction invoice. Corrections are given to the retailers on the first pickup of every week. Once the accounting process is done, the recycling function begins. CRINC processes about 80,000 pounds of cans per day. This is approximately 2,240,000 cans. The cans are first crushed in a densifier, then baled, and prepared for transport to aluminum processors to be made into new cans. Plastic containers are perforated, crushed, and baled, ready for recycling into carpet or fabric fibers. Thousands of returnable bottles must be sorted by brand and size, then palletized for pickup each day. 300,000 pounds of non-refillable glass bottles are processed each day. They must be sorted by color, crushed, and prepared for transport to glass processors to be made into new glass bottles. Distributors, not retail, are charged for these services, including pickups at retail, sorting, and palletizing returnable, baling aluminum, and crushing glass. Because CRINC is centralized, we are able to keep close track of everything. Nothing slips through the cracks, nothing goes to waste. The CRINC system is designed to address the needs of all concerned. It frees up trucks so wholesalers and bottlers can deliver products more efficiently. It reduces space and storage problems for both retailers and wholesalers. Retailers also benefit from a high level of service, thorough removal of empty containers, and complete and accurate accounting system. In other words, CRINC offers an efficient alternative to guesstimating. at no cost to the retailer. Craig counts every single item and pays the retailer based on actual counts. And those counts can be impressive. Each bottle or can may only be worth a nickel, but those nickels add up. In fact, each day, Craig handles over $175,000 deposit dollars, and it's those deposit dollars that the entire bottle bill system is centered around. The Craig system has been built on a commitment to accountability, and that's as it should be. To leave the accountability of a system this large to anyone other than those responsible for its managing just simply wouldn't make sense. In addition to being accountable, the beverage industry invests over $7 million per year in the operation of this program, and in 1998 spent $7.5 million to make the operation more efficient for both retailers and wholesalers. This is a tremendous commitment from the industry committed to making the bottle bill work for Oregonians. The simple, balanced program has proven to work. The responsibility is where it should be, with the bottling industry. Containers not covered in the bottle bill are easily handled by the curbside recycling program. Disrupting the current program could result in its demise. Oregon should be proud of what it has created. Our bottle bill program is the only one like it west of the Mississippi. The redemption program in California has resulted in program administration costs in excess of $25 million. Even so, California's recycling rates still fall far short of state mandated levels. In Oregon, no public money is spent on returning bottle bill containers or on administration. Oregon has pioneered a program that works. We can continue to be a leader in showing how government, industry, and the community can work together for the benefit of the environment around us. Let's keep our bottle bill intact and keep a good thing going for Oregon.
Yes, I just wanted to do a closing here. This is a video that is a couple of years old, and there's a correction I need to make in it. The amount of bottle deposit that we're handling these days is closer to 150,000, not 175, as the film said. And also, the House Resolution 2 says that by 1988, I'm not sure if that meant 78 or 80, I mean 98 or 88, said the beverage container return rates in Oregon were calculated at about 93%. Crink picks up and recycles about 56% of the number of returnable containers sold in the state, and Crink, as you heard, does a lot of sophisticated accounting and counts every container. And the recycling rate averages over 97% at Crink. So if you use that as an extrapolation, we probably have closer to a 97-98% return rate on those containers in Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sandra. At this point, I'm going to call Representative Starr, who is the sponsor of this bill, one of the co-sponsors. And I'm going to close the hearing on H.R. 2 and open a public hearing on H.R. 2 and H.R. 3 so that Representative Starr can give testimony on both.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Representative in House District 3 in Washington County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on both of the resolutions very much. And I'll get right to that so I can get back to the chair of the committee here in a minute. H.R. 2. This resolution celebrates one of Oregon's proudest moments, the birth of the bottle bill. We often take for granted how relatively litter-free Oregon is today. 30 years ago, our roads, beaches, parks were often plagued by large amounts of unsightly and harmful garbage. Not a very pretty word, is it? I try to think, how can I make that a prettier word? You can't pretty up garbage. Unpleasant deposits of garbage spotted public trails and beaches. This included many kinds of different kinds of garbage, but but 49% to 82% of it was made up of various beverage containers. In 1971, however, along came a bill that put the bottles, this one category of garbage, almost into extinction. House Bill 1036 required a 5-cent deposit on all beer and soft drink bottles. Bottles began to disappear from the sides of Oregon's roads in dramatic numbers. And as we all know, Oregon became a trendsetter on the ecological cutting edge. The bottle bill created a name for Oregon as a state that was forward in its thinking. In essence, Oregon became a benchmark in the environmental scale of accomplishment. H.R. 2 celebrates this notable Oregon achievement. It also serves to remind and inspire us not only of the importance conservation has played in Oregon's history, but also the innovative measures that have been and hopefully will continue to be used in the state of Oregon. And as on a personal note, I just think it's important for us to recognize where we have been as a state, and hopefully we can continue to build on the kinds of innovation and creativity that has marked Oregon for quite a number of decades. With that, I will offer some short testimony on H.R. 3. H.R. 3, Oregon's coast is truly one of Oregon's most identifiable landmarks. When people across the world think of Oregon, they think of her miles and miles of unique and recognizable pristine beaches. However, the access the public has to all 355 miles of Oregon's remarkable coast truly sets it apart. Oregon has a history of fighting for public access to beaches. In 1913, Governor West set aside the beach's wet tide area as state highway to ever be open for public use. Then it was become the famous Oregon Beach Bill in 1967. The legislature set apart the Oregon coast 300 feet inward from the high water mark for public use. Ever since then, Oregon has had an unquestionable policy of having the beauty of Oregon's beaches always open to public enjoyment. For generations, we have preserved this extraordinary natural wonder, and we can continue to do that for generations to come. This resolution celebrates our past and future efforts to that end. I serve on a task force on election laws, an NCSL task force. We met once a month, basically every month this year, except January. And one of my colleagues on that task force is a senator from Mississippi. And we were talking, he's enamored with Oregon and its environment. And Southwest Airlines, I don't know if any of you have flown on Southwest. Southwest had a coast-to-coast sale on their air flare, and he thought, man, I've never been to Oregon. So I just asked him, why made you come to Oregon? Well, I've never been there. So he hopped on a flight from Mississippi to Oregon. And what did he do when he came to Oregon, the senator from Mississippi? He drove down I-5 down to Lane County, and they crossed to the coast and drove up the Oregon coastline, Highway 101. Why? Because Oregon's reputation of its coastline, it's the beauty of the Oregon coast and the beauty of our beaches. I think part of that, part of the reputation that Oregon has is because the Oregon legislature so many years ago had the foresight to say, hey, our beaches, our beautiful coast, should be open for all of Oregonians, not only all Oregonians, but anybody who can venture to Oregon to experience what we all know is so beautiful. And I'll tell you that it's a many a Sunday afternoon that my family and I jump in the car and drive the short hour or so to the coast to spend some time digging in the sand and playing in the surf on a summer afternoon. And it's a pleasure of mine to sponsor these resolutions, and I would ask that you give your stamp of approval and send them on their merry way. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you so much. Questions, Representative Cruz?
Yes, Representative, what's special about the 34th?
You know, when I thought of the, I thought that question would come up.
We missed the 30th, didn't we?
Yeah, well, that was one thing. We missed the 30th, and we could wait till the 40th, which would be 6 years from now. But I thought it was,
for 10 minutes.
To me, it was important enough to to just make note of it. And since we kind of just did these resolutions together, we said, well, it's 34, but, you know, 34 is an important year. Somebody's going to turn 34 this year.
Carefully a follow-up.
You lost some points there. My other question would be, when the senator from Mississippi was here and he was driving up the coast, did he pick up bottles and cans and count?
No comment.
Thank you very much.
I would have.
Thank you so much. I'm closing the public hearing on HR 3 and HR 2. Those are all the people who had signed up to testify. I'm going to open a public, a work session on HR 2.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I move HR 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan has moved HR 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hall?
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
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 Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Monica
Anderson? Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Both aye. Motion carries. Representative Starr will carry HR 2. And I'm opening a work session on HR 3.
Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I move HR 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morgan has moved HR 3 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Jensen? Aye. Representative Cruz? Aye. Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Both aye. HR 3 has passed. We'll go to the House floor, and Speaker Simmons will carry that bill. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3872. Requires issuance of permit to person who removes dwelling from land zone for exclusive farm use to allow replacement dwelling. And Megan, can you give us any more information on this bill? And I'm going to call forward Don Schellenberg and Dave Van Ash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. With me is Dave Van Ash, agriculture producer from Washington County. Dave is part of our Land Use Advisory Committee. And during the course of our discussions over the years, we've argued back and forth as a committee land use issues on both sides of those issues. Dave brought this issue to our attention. It happened to be an issue that affected him directly regarding replacement dwellings. As you know, most farmers, when they look for a piece of land, they aren't looking for a piece of land with a house on it, unless they don't have a house. There is a limited amount of those that market for that. But basically, they want to put their money into the land, not into improvements on the land. And so this issue affected him, and he brought that to our committee. They adopted a resolution, became part of our policy, and then it was recommended as part of our legislative agenda. So with that, Madam Chair, I have two bills down in the Senate Ag Committee going on, and I will just leave Mr. Van Ash in your capable hands and ask for your support for the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a good hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Dave Van Ash, and I live at 36130 Northwest Wren Road, Cornelius, Oregon. So I'm west of Portland there, about 20 miles. And my wife and I operate about a 2,000-acre seed farm, grass seed, legume seed, a little bit of grain. And over the years, we've bought some additional farms, and a couple of those have had dwellings on them. And one case in particular, we bought the farm based on the appraised value of the farm. And the farm had a $50,000 additional appraisal because of this old house that was on the property. And it's almost uninhabitable, but it could be fixed up. And so anyway, there's a lot of those in my area that farmers rent out. We have a couple more that we rent out that at some point in time it gets to the point where you don't want to put any more money into them. But you don't want to tear them down either because if you tear them down, you can't replace them. So at the present time, the farm replacement standard, or the farm dwelling replacement standard is, you can take out a permit to get a replacement dwelling, but the permit is only good for 2 years, at least in Washington County. And what this bill would allow is, it would allow the replacement time to be an indefinite period of time for the farmer or the landowner's life or his spouse or children. It couldn't be transferred on in a sale to another person. You'd have to use it yourself. I don't want this to be retroactive going backwards. It would only apply to those buildings that are still standing, so to speak. So if this law was enacted, my concept is you would file for a replacement dwelling. And if you got the replacement dwelling based on the dwelling that was still standing, then you could take this permit and take it to the building department, planning department, and get a permanent voucher for that particular tax lot. And I've kind of specified all that in my language here. Things such as building code, safety, health, that sort of thing. You would have to apply whatever the standard was at the time that the building was replaced. You know, if that's 20 years from now and the building codes have all changed, well, you're going to have to apply the new building codes. But at the present time, if you tear this house down and it doesn't exist anymore, then you have to apply the income standards, $80,000 on high-value EFU land, and that's where the problem occurs. The farmers out there would like to tear down a lot of these old houses, and they don't, and they're just, they're eyesores. So we'd like to clean up the community.
So you get this voucher, permanent voucher, meaning that you don't have to replace the house, but you can if you want.
That's correct. You may never replace it, so it's not going to add any additional farm homes out there that don't exist now, and it may, in fact, actually reduce some of them.
Questions? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I have is why were grandchildren not included? And I make that question on the basis that with the kind of changing patterns that we have today, I see the children not going back to the farm necessarily, but grandchildren being the ones that go back to the farm. And so I guess I'm concerned whether you'd be amenable to amendment of that type.
Sure. That brings a question to me. I just went through changing my will, and I have a generational skipping trust from my parents to my children, where I don't even inherit my parents' farm because of estate tax purposes.
Sure.
But the concept was to keep it in the family.
Well, but I understand the concept, that.
And once you sell it to someone else, you've lost the right to do that.
Thank you.
Would that be an amendment you would like us to submit?
Sure. I guess Farm Bureau 1000 Friends would have to, agree to that. I don't think it's a problem.
Okay.
With Farm Bureau, anyway.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Karen Kirshner, 1000 Friends.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Kirshner, staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. 1000 Friends of Oregon supports the concept and the identified problem that basically led to the development of the Farm Bureau's policy and House Bill 3872. Namely, Mr. Dave Van Ash testified to the increased costs that farmers can incur by virtue of acquiring land that already has a dwelling on it. And I see House Bill 3872 as an attempt to balance the needs of the farmer to acquire additional land without requiring them to lose the additional investment that they were basically forced to make because of houses that we have in farmland that aren't perhaps being used for that purpose right now. I note that the bill at this point does not specify necessarily that it is prospective, and that is the intent of the drafters of this legislation. Therefore, I would propose that we put in specific language stating that the bill that House Bill 3872 applies to dwellings removed on or after its date of enactment for which a replacement dwelling permit is issued on or after that date of enactment. I would also suggest that the bill currently as written does reflect the requirements of the replacement dwellings, both in the those counties that do have marginal land statutes as well as the remainder of the counties in Oregon. I would recommend that there be some verification process that the building does indeed meet the specified requirements of being currently inhabitable is essentially what they reflect. With that, I will certainly be happy to discuss or answer any questions that this committee might have with respect to the bill.
Questions? Representative Monica Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if any of these would be considered historical? About homes?
Chair Close,
Representative
Anderson, I have not looked at that. Actually, that raises an interesting question, and I did not look into that. I was looking at it, I guess, solely from the perspective of the farming industry, and hadn't looked into that. I will make an attempt to do so and discuss any problems that raises with the Oregon Farm Bureau.
There may be statute already that would cover it, or not.
Chair Close, Representative Mona Sanderson, there are already some protections surrounding historical buildings, and I guess to any extent that might override it, we would just want to make that analysis.
Thank you. Mr. Van Ash would like to comment on the historical building.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to make a comment.
You can come to the podium. You're going to have to give your name again. I'm sorry.
Fix that recording.
My name is Dave Van Ash, and Madam Chair and Committee, I'd like to just make the comment that I believe under the present replacement dwelling standard, the historical concept is already taken care of.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay. Our last person to testify is Ron Eber of DLCD.